Americans are durable. We take pride in hard work and high quality. American Giant makes durable, quality clothing right here in the USA. Because what we wear reflects who we are. When you buy American Giant, you're not just wearing the best clothes money can buy. You're helping keep jobs and pride in your own backyard. Premium clothing built to last decades, like it should. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code RIGHTHERE24.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're here to continue, actually to conclude our expectations series tonight. This is the 30th of 30 episodes. Tonight, we're going to talk about Nate Wiggins and Nick Samak. If you know the show, you know it's one offensive and one defensive player in almost all of these episodes. So we're doing following that format again. Joining me to talk about this is someone who's especially qualified to talk about these two rookies, and that's Jonas Schaefer. Jonas, how you doing?
Good to see you again. Thanks for having me on. It means the training camp is here. It's close.
We are indeed getting close. Looking forward to it. And two draftees. And now OTAs and minicamp. I haven't been out there yet, and I'm itching to see both of these guys. Whether it's certainly in camp, but also in the preseason, in terms of both these guys hopefully having some healthy and significant playing time.
Yeah, not a whole lot to report on from OTAs and from rookie minicamp. Obviously, as we're going to talk about with Samak, he's probably fully healthy from that. I believe it was a fractured fibula, so I didn't see a lot of him at rookie minicamp. He was sidelined for I think most of OTAs, and then I think he might have played in two of the three or all three of the minicamp practices that we saw. And with Wiggins, obviously. What stands out about him just on a first impressions level is just the size and just how skinny he is. And frankly, a lot of the reps that he got were with the twos, which is, typically on the farther field from where us in the media are looking on. So, we got good looks at him, but not the best looks at him because our attention was kind of divided, but enough to come away impressed and not as picked on as someone like TJ Tampa, for instance, who gave up a couple long passes. Nate Wiggins wasn't perfect, certainly during the few practices that I got a chance to watch him. And we can talk about how that was maybe a result of some of his weaknesses and stuff like that. But I definitely feel more comfortable about kind of knowing his readiness for NFL football than someone like Nick Samak, who is just kind of a black box at this point to me.
Okay, let's start with Samak, since he's certainly the undercard of this pair. We'll work through him. Center out of Michigan State, drafted in the seventh round, number 228. He's got fairly typical size for an interior offensive lineman at 6'4", 307, 32 and three-quarter inch arms. Is actually pretty decent for an interior lineman, particularly for a center. Maybe a little bit in terms of an athlete, a little more Bozeman-esque than you might like. He's a 5'25", 40 guy. He's not a guy who can really burn like Linderbaum can in level two. One of the things that really came out of a lot of the reports, and honestly, more the reports than the little bit of film I watched, was the ability to pull and make reach and cutoff blocks. There are actually a fairly limited number of pull blocks that I saw him make in the film I watched from Michigan State. But with the Ravens' frequent counter plays, that seems like something that he'd be very good at.
Yeah, just to be prepared for this podcast, if you guys are interested in draft coverage or interested in draft film, I subscribe to Caddy's Cutups. I'm not sure if you do, Ken, but it's a really nice Patreon account where you can pay, I think, as little as $1 or $3 a month for a pretty nice library of full game film cutups. A lot of it is, by player. So you get them you know, spot shadowed on each play. And there's only one game from 2023 of Michigan State. It was against Iowa, so that's a high level defense. I don't think they had anyone who was a, you know, top prospect along that interior that, you know, you can measure same neck against in the same way that, like we'll talk about with Wiggins, you know, he went up against Devontae Walker, he went up against Johnny Wilson, he went up against Keon Coleman. So it's a little bit tough to figure out exactly, you know, what level of competition he was up against. But when he got out in space, I think he was pretty impressive. You know, he's a guy who plays through the whistle. He put a couple guys on their ass, not just linebackers, but defensive linemen as well, handling double teams. So, you know, he's not a lumbering type despite having all that nice size. And it's nice that he doesn't have to compromise on, you know, just his general frame to be a guy who can get out in space and do some creative stuff in the run game. So I was pretty impressed by just the one, you know, 12-minute film cut up that I watched before I hopped on with you. But I think a lot to like, and I imagine him falling as late as he did in the draft probably had to do with some, you know, trepidation just about his readiness for rookie year with that fractured fibula.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's been no information that came on out yet as far as where that fibula break was. Was it near the ankle or further up or what?
I don't think so.
No information. Okay. So that's a very big deal. Obviously, the closer to the ankle, the worse. You don't want to chip off part of the bone there at the end. You know, one of the reasons that I'm not all that concerned about his athleticism is because the Ravens have been so good at training unathletic offensive linemen to be good pullers. I mean, I'm not making light of the situation, but James Hurst and Bradley Bozeman were not outstanding athletes. In fact, it was the big knock on Bradley Bozeman coming out of school, and they were prolific pullers in their time at left guard, both of them. And I think both of them, and you can add Skura to that group and others, were guys who came to work very well in terms of making the backside blocks on run plays where they had to go at a shallow angle because somebody was vacating a spot. So oftentimes at center, if the left guard and left tackle are both pulling to the right, has to come at a very shallow angle. You have to understand the football very well because the footwork very well, so you don't have, you're not impeding the player moving the opposite direction as you effectively. The Ravens are just proven marvelous at teaching that. Dallas Andrus is, you know, that's where a lot of his value, I think, is in teaching those fundamentals extremely well.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of the Ravens having success on those pulls and the more creative runs in their playbook, we should give credit to Lamar Jackson for. You know, obviously, if he is faking or motioning somewhere or just being a nuisance to the backside of the play or the front side of the play, then maybe that is just, that gives these guys the half second they need for, you know, to kind of capture the attention of the linebackers or the safeties or whoever's in the box that they would otherwise flow to a little bit more instinctively, because, you know, you see a puller and it's your responsibility to match that. Maybe you're a little bit more wary of doing that when it's Lamar in the backfield as opposed to someone like Josh Johnson or Devin Leary.
Right. I've been watching recently, going back and scoring old offensive lines so I can complete the team history of it. But I'm in 2005 right now. We're working through that season. And wow. I can tell you the Mike Flynn pulling, it ain't all about who the quarterback is. Kyle Bowler is a skittish squirrel under center, which is actually kind of, in some ways it's funny. In some ways it's like, how did I live through this era of Ravens football and not just be screaming at the TV set continually? But Bowler gets stepped on all the time by both guards and the center. And there's one play where he gets both feet stepped on the same play. And some of it is him coming out under center improperly. But I think also Mike Flynn, as much as a longtime Raven, very well thought of, you know, as a center, really had a lot of footwork issues. And the Ravens didn't have really good coaching at the time to work out this footwork. And then they've had lesser centers, you know, basically in the time since and footwork with Skura and McCary and Bozeman and Linderbaum has never been the problem. I mean, this with these guys, I mean, they have problems with snaps. They've had problems with some other things about pass blocking, right. But footwork, not at all. So I'm really impressed. I give Dallas Sanders the credit. You may be right that Lamar Jackson may be playing a part in that. I would as much as I love Lamar, he's the heart of the run game. I think most of the credit deserves to go to Dallas Sanders for this.
For sure, for sure. And actually, I will say one of the things that I jotted in my notes was, and again, this is just one game, but I did not notice basically a single bad snap from Samak. A lot of shotgun snaps in that game against Iowa. So
how was trajectory on those snaps? Trajectory and velocity midsection?
Yeah, it was usually, I didn't really see the quarterback have to reach pretty much anywhere. I didn't have to see him, lean down to get a kind of wobbler. So, a lot of those angles, it's from behind the quarterback. So you're not getting the full picture of how it's coming in. But again, it was notable in how inconspicuous some of those snaps were.
It's very good to hear. That is very good to hear. If you look at the PFF grading last year, and in fact, throughout his career, not the greatest run blocker, but his run blocking has improved a little bit every year at Michigan State, if you believe the PFF numbers.
Yeah, and I thought he was very active, very aware, very observant in the Iowa game. One of the, I think that my highlights from watching that cut up was, he's, it's normal drop back. He handles the backside one technique. So the guy who's lined up in front of him, and then a guy on the backside of the play who's I think he was an outside linebacker, or maybe a safety, but he's basically lined up as the seven tech. So, we're talking a couple gaps over, is just this very severe loop where he's basically supposed to be, hidden from view basically by all the action that's happening up front. And Samak takes care of his guy, shoves him from left to right, and then at the last possible moment processes that there is this guy, a looper, coming free, and he somehow gets to him, pushes him just far enough upfield where the quarterback can step up into the pocket and give him another second to go through his reads. And that was just really, really impressive that he had the ability to take on both those blocks. I know obviously that is the expectation when you get to the NFL level, to be able to make those kind of reads, to be able to go from one guy to the next. But I thought it was just a really, really impressive bit of processing, technique, fundamentals, athleticism, the whole package all rolled into one really nice highlight.
All right. It sounds extremely encouraging. You tell from this, the amount of film I've watched on Nick Samak is limited, to say the least. I'm going to look at the caddies cut up that you suggest here. I often look for that. You know what I really would love to have in terms of college cutups is, I'd love for people to pull together the bad plays of individual players. And my reasoning is this: if you want highlights, if you want to look at everybody's, if every sack a player had, you can find that pretty easily. You can find every interception Emmanuel Forbes had last year. And you can then, piece together what were similar about this, there are enough interceptions, actually a meaningful, sample size you're working with. How does he usually work to intercept the football? That's very useful to me. What I want is for receivers, give me all 8 or 9 drops that he had on the season. For running backs, give me all the missed tackles forced, so I can look at them and I can see what's similar about this. Is he running through contact? Is he putting a hand on the ground? Is he too slippery that people are whiffing? I'd love to have ways to categorize that. I'm sure it's coming. I'm sure we'll be able to look at that in some service that we'll probably initially have to pay a lot of money for, that we will consider very worth it.
Yeah, well, I just take things off in a strange direction, but I know that the SEC, maybe some conferences, have been very litigious about keeping all 22 film off the internet. It's very strange that, as we see the rise of guys like Dan Orlovsky and, these film gurus who put very complex scheme talk into digestible, 2-minute packages, on the college side, it is very, very tough to not only get your hands on college film, but to actually, share it widely. I think that there are a couple, very well-known YouTube content creators who have had just whole videos that would otherwise get tens or hundreds of thousands of views, stricken from the YouTube servers because someone affiliated with the conference, ran it through, or it got flagged because the film was technically copyrighted. So I think we still have a ways to go before we see this democratization of college content. But if you're looking for bad stuff from Samak, I think the write-ups on him, and one of the things that contributed to his dropping was just a little bit of concerns about his ability and pass protection. And I think the biggest demerit from the game that I saw, it wasn't entirely his fault. It looks like there was a bit of miscommunication on a drop back. You know, the left guard kind of goes, kind of into no man's land where he's not really taking anyone. So the three tech or the four tech basically has a pretty clear path to the quarterback. Samak's kind of shaded his direction. And so he picks him up, but he really approaches him from like an angle where he cannot fully kind of anchor down and just leverage the strength and the technique he has. So the guy, I don't think there's a sack on the play or maybe in a quarterback hit, but the defensive lineman basically knocks him back, basically kind of Heisman's him as Samak is trying to hold on for dear life. And it is not pretty, but I think that is probably just a concern of, can this guy, if he's thrust into a situation where he has to handle like Dexter Lawrence, for instance, late in the season, mm-hmm. does he have any chance in hell of winning, more than 3 out of 4 reps?
Yeah, that was the problem for Linderbaum, and it was obviously a big problem as a rookie, and he fixed a lot of that in year two. So I just kind of hope with Samak we can get an idea of his developmental track in year one without losing Linderbaum to do it. And that doesn't leave a lot. It leaves basically preseason, maybe some mop up time. But let's talk about what we kind of expect from him out of this season before we get into good and great though. Would you say it's reasonable? You think it's likely that the Ravens will try and have him be the 1-for-1 nuclear replacement option for Linderbaum if he gets hurt, and probably try and keep McCary available at tackle?
Yeah, I think that's the Occam's razor route for me, assuming that he is just not totally overwhelmed in training camp, or assuming that leg and every other body part that he has makes it through August healthy. I think that is probably the ideal situation. And to me, that probably signals that he is more likely than not to make the 53. Obviously, there's a whole lot of, roster machinations that could go into whether he does or doesn't. Mm-hmm. But I just feel like because of how valuable center has been, because of how valuable a center will be to this whole operation, are you asking McCary, to be the guy who has to prepare in any given week for the other team's top edge rusher, as well as being clued into all of the stuff that Lamar might have going on before the snap with cadences, with changing protections, with audibling in and out of plays? I just think that the mental, course load, the mental workload that is going to be placed on these centers this year is probably bigger than it has been at any point.
Because of Zeitler?
Not just Zeitler, but just, the empowerment of Lamar to do stuff more actively before the snap. I think that has been a big plank of this Todd Monken offseason. And I just think, I don't know how much of an imposition is on these guys time-wise, but it seems like it would be asking a lot of a guy who already does so much, and Patrick McCary, to be able to know, what Lamar wants, at a moment's notice as an emergency center, in addition to having prepared for God knows who else, on the defense all week.
I'm just going to say, I think it's an enormous burden on Linderbaum as well. And it's one of the real growth elements he needs. It's another hurdle for him to succeed in, because no Zeitler, that's a lot of the knowledge and ability to make checks. And obviously he's also the guy who looks back at Lamar and taps the thing. Not that other players can't learn that, but something tells me a rookie and Voorhees and Ben Cleveland are not the ideal pair of guards to be the savvy veterans to do that job. And Zeitler was really special in that way. So we'll see how that works out. I think it's a lot more pressure on Linderbaum. And if Samak were to come in and he had to take up all of Linderbaum's role, that's just to me would be a pretty extreme situation.
To be fair though, I was very, very pessimistic about the Ravens having a chance to do anything on the ground against the Bengals for that game where Mustafer had to go because Linderbaum was dinged up, and things went pretty smoothly. So I don't know if that's more credit to Mustipher or to Lamar or to Monken or just to what we learned was a pretty dismal Bengals defense. But that was a game that was pretty smooth for Mustipher. I think he had like one or two holding penalties that he was pretty aggrieved about. But I think that was otherwise a pretty good game for him, stepping in for a guy who, you know, I think we all thought was pretty closely replaceable.
We're talking, this is in week two, right? When they first game they play, because I just want to bring that up for a second, see how I scored Mustipher in that game. But two holding penalties is going to probably be an F right away. No, not true. He's got one holding penalty against Cincinnati that I can see, or 6 points in penalties, which means 10 yards. And I scored him at 0.85 overall for a C+ in that game. So that's very solid for stepping in. Yeah. If you have a backup center who can come in, or any backup lineman who can come in and play at a C level, that's pretty terrific.
That's the Patrick McCary value in a nutshell, right?
It's the model. That's the Patrick McCary model, yes. Let's talk about what's a good year and a great year for Nick Samak. So start us off with a good year for Nick.
I think probably the most elemental part of this is just making the 53. I think it's knowing that he can have a full year of development on this roster, get stronger with the Ravens strength staff, get more familiar with the playbook. And I think probably the grand hope, the grand ambition from Ravens officials is something that John Harbaugh, I believe, mentioned not long after they took him, which is not just developing into a guy who you can trust to be a, you know, reliable backup center, but might also develop into a reliable backup guard, or perhaps a, you know, a contender to start at guard somewhere down the line. I mean, obviously, I don't think he played anywhere else but center at Michigan State, but you don't have to have a wild imagination to imagine that a guy with his body type, you know, decently long arms, good size, moves well wherever you need him to go, could potentially have the kind of skill set where he could, you know, step in at guard either side one day. So I think it's probably just making a team, you know, not screwing things up, not having a, you know, McCary like meltdown in Buffalo in the rain, where he's just, you know, put Lamar in harm's way, getting the offense off schedule with horrible snaps. So I think, you know, you're hoping that he probably only plays like 50, 100 snaps this year, because otherwise that means that Linderbaum's hurt again. But if he can just be a guy who is there from, you know, late July to, you know,
mid-February,
yeah, getting as many snaps and lessons as possible from Tyler Linderbaum, who's, you know, much beloved in that locker room, I think that would do a lot for his development and really help them, that the Ravens get a lot of value from a otherwise forgettable day three pick.
All right, here's my good. A lot of overlap with you. Cut and retain to the practice squad. Now, here's how I came to this conclusion. I'm saying I think there's probably about a 60% chance that he gets cut, maybe 65, because I think he, at the top of the practice squad, the Ravens retain him. I don't think he has to be part of roster machinations, but it's possible he makes the team on that basis. We've talked about carrying 10, carrying 9 linemen, which is reasonable. The Ravens are the most adept team in the entire National Football League in terms of using the margin of the roster to make sure they are fully stoked as the season goes on with fresh bodies returning. The problem is the NFL has institutionalized some of that by adding these two spots at the end of the roster, which the Ravens could always create for themselves with use of the handshake crew. So right. you cut a veteran, bring him back. I know, you know, I'm telling the people out here, but you know, that unfortunately that's been institutionalized for the whole league right now. So where the Ravens used to have 56 or 57 men on their 53 man roster, including the projected DTRs, then maybe they have 58 now, and other teams will have 57 or 56 and not quite use the roster as well on the edge. At least that's the way I'm hoping. So I think there's actually a good chance he gets cut, given who the Ravens have otherwise on the offensive line, who kind of need to have a spot. And McCary can get you through one game, but I don't want him as the long-term answer. I want Samak as the answer, because I think they need to carry it back up tackle. So I think he gets elevated to the 53 at some point. Injuries may open a spot for him on the IOL at some point. Any one of the guards gets injured, obviously, he's probably the first guy who gets brought up at that point. Allows him to carry all five of the guys who can play offensive tackle, including Jones, Falele McCary, Rosengarten, and of course Stanley. I want him to learn the Ravens' way to pull and cut off with low angles on the backside in this first year. So do the things well that Dallas Sanders has taught well. It's not a high goal. Obviously, it doesn't need to result in any on-field play. I want to develop the grown man's strength. You already talked about the year in the weight room. And still in the Ravens' plans and projects to a 2025 roster spot. If he gets zero snaps the whole year, I'm perfectly happy at this 60th percentile thing. But it could also result in him getting, you know, 40, 50 snaps, like you said. I think you've got the range of play right for what a good season is there at about 50 snaps.
Yeah, and I'm frankly not sure what else I could add for a great season, because I just don't know, like the limits on a guy who they took this late in the draft at a position that is so rock solid with Linderbaum. I mean, I guess it's just like, you know, show that you can hack it if you're thrust in there. Don't have a grade below 50 on PFF. I don't know what else I could add for what would constitute a great season for a guy who is, as you said, you know, as kind of close to the, or who is on the roster bubble as firmly as he is.
I think I liked your development at a guard stuff. You know, if there's some way that he projects to a guard, I'd put that in the great category myself. And I didn't, and I feel bad about it now, but you did good. Here's my grade. Earns a roster spot with preseason play and OL attrition. Or OL attrition. Active some, but not all weeks. Plays sparingly as a reserve and sixth offensive lineman with 30 to 150 snaps in relief. Pass blocking difficulties in preseason and regular season play are less than expected. And a rookie development curve, his rookie development curve is on track for a league average NFL center. That means he's not starting at a league average level, but he projects to be a league average center at some point in the future. And that's okay. The Ravens developed that. That's a really good backup. Hand fighting technique and blitz stunt recognition improves to be able to compete as a pass blocker at the NFL level. And that's regardless of the rookie results. If he takes a step up from some very uneven college play, I'm happy with that. Snaps are direct and at the midsection. And you mentioning what you've seen on tape is a good spot towards that. And works hard to become the offensive line leader if he's installed at center in a trial by fire. And again, you know, they'll prepare him as best they can. And, you know, you trust the Ravens coaches, but in the end, that player's got to go out there. He's got to get the snap right. He's got the calls right. And there ain't going to be no one helping him, you know, because those guards next to him, at least the way I think about it right now, are not really prepared to do it either.
Right. Yeah, I guess throw in just getting stronger, getting smarter, getting healthier, all that good stuff. You mentioning the possibility of him being a sixth offensive lineman. Forgive me for not knowing, Ken, but have you done a Falele season preview yet?
Yes. Yeah.
Was one of the details in your or your guest's great season catching a touchdown pass from Derrick Henry?
No, I did not have that, but that's an interesting one. It'd be
I was reminded. I mean, obviously, I think the Derrick Henry touchdown pass in that divisional round upset of the Ravens is probably burned into everyone's memory listening here. But I randomly got served on YouTube the other day, just the collection of all the Derrick Henry touchdown passes. And I was reminded that I think Dana Filoli at Minnesota either ran a touchdown in or caught a touchdown. So that would, I'm sure, just break the internet, as they say, if Derrick Henry were to throw a touchdown to Daniel Falele. And it's something that I'm surprised they haven't even attempted once to Falele, because of just how big he is and how unlikely a candidate he would be to get to that second level on, you know, whatever run play the Ravens could drum up for him.
You were, I don't know if you were following the Ravens at the time Helodio Nonato was here. The year would have been like 2008 to 2010 when they used Nada as a sixth offensive lineman a lot, actually a seventh. They would bring in a sixth offensive lineman, then Nada would be number seven on the end playing tight end in theory. He went out for a pattern like four times, but he's unbelievably dominant as a blocker. But on 10-10-10, October 10, 2010, he ran a pattern on the very first series, hurt himself, and was unable to start the game defensively. Okay. And he did. He played the game defensively later, but he couldn't start the game. The practice was immediately ended of having him in there on those plays. So, but it was always fun to watch that pattern.
I wonder if that memory ever linked. Well, we never really got to the bottom of the Joe Flacco out wide pass, or like, do you remember that kind of awkward period where it was before Lamar had taken over, but they were still wanting to get him involved in their specialty packages with Marty Mortenweg, and Joe would occasionally line up at wide receiver and just not do anything. Mm-hmm. And like, I think we asked Marty about it once or twice, and he kind of, you know, had a glint in his eye, like something's coming, like this is all setting up something. But I wonder if it was just a little bit of civil disobedience from Joe, where it's just like, I saw what happened to Lodi Nata on 10-10-10. You're not going to get me to do anything. Right. I'm just going to sit here and wait until the play's over, because no way I'm going to put my body through any more hell to run a stupid route for you in this play that I am already strenuously objecting to.
You know, there was something that I really wanted to see after Joe lost his starting job to Lamar, but you're probably right that Joe would have had no interest in doing this. He and Yanda understood the dance steps to the quarterback sneak better than any quarterback center combo I've ever seen. I mean, they're just outstanding at it. And, you know, it was usually 2 yards every play instead of you hope you get 1 yard, which is with a lot of quarterbacks when the line gets jammed. He knew how to take it over right guard instead of going over center. You know, all the things you want to do. Didn't have to go through the A gap. I wish that would have been possible, because there were some blown fourth and ones with Lamar in 2018 at the end of the season. I'm thinking, you know, why isn't Joe Flacco in there? Joe Flacco can run the QB sneak. And yeah, you might've been telegraphing it a little bit, but
there was also the terribly botched fourth and one against the Titans in that same playoff loss.
Yep. All right. Well, let's move on. We'll talk about Nate Wiggins now. So you mentioned his size, obviously. I'm going to talk about, just for a second, if you don't mind me monologuing here a little bit, why I loved Wiggins so much coming out of this draft. Because he's got basically decent size for a corner in terms of height and okay in terms of length. Substandard, a little bit substandard, but right, not terribly short at 30 and a half inches. 4'28", 40, great jumps. Jumps right out of the building. And, you know, obviously probably is a great basketball player, I would guess, from the way that he jumps. But the fastest 40 time in the cornerbacks at the combine. And that's great. If you want Darius Hayward Bay, you know, you go get this guy up for that alone. But he corroborated that great athletic profile with outstanding college coverage metrics. It include 4.3 yards per target. And it was not a low volume target. I mean, famously didn't allow allowed one play over 18 yards the whole year. And that was to Tez Walker. But he also was targeted a ton, 6.8 snaps per, sorry. Yeah, he was targeted every 6.8 snaps of coverage. So that's high for a guy who's an NFL prospect. In fact, he was 87th of 190 cornerbacks who had a minimum level of playing time. Long A dot. They threw deep on him all the time. He had a couple interceptions, only allowed one touchdown and a 44.4 opposition passer rating. You rarely get that combination of elite athleticism with the corroborating statistics that go with it from college. It's often reserved for the very top of the draft, the top 5-6 picks. Devin Witherspoon had the same kind of profile in terms of being just unbelievably talented in terms of his coverage statistics stood out above everyone else. But Wiggins is a guy, obviously, you know, people think Emmanuel Forbes now when they look at him. They think this is a smaller guy who's going to be held back by that.
Yeah. When I was looking at some film and preparing for this pod, I was trying to come up with an evocative description for people who haven't seen Nate Wiggins in person to describe just how thin his lower body is. And I was going to say like hips of a model, but there are, you know, there are models who have wide hips and skinny hips. I guess it just depends on what kind of magazine
your body shape.
The body type. And I know like this guy is 6 or 7 inches taller, but were you much of a basketball fan? Have you been much of a basketball fan throughout your life?
Not too much, but if you're going to talk about Muggsy Bogues or somebody like that, I know who you're talking about.
No. Yeah. Do you remember the physical figure, the physical profile that Tayshaun Prince cut during his days at Kentucky and then in the NBA?
Honestly, no.
He was just like a rail thin guy whose success in the NBA was all the more surprising because of it. I think he was on those Pistons teams that maybe won a title not a decade ago, but longer than that. He was a part of some really, really good teams, despite being just a rail thin guy. And that's who I kind of landed on as just like a, you know, knee jerk reaction for how he looks, at least in the lower body. You know, he's a little bit more built up in the upper body. He's obviously going to probably put on some more pounds. That's the plan from according to the Ravens, but he's definitely not a guy that he's a guy who you would expect to wear skinny jeans, because it very much fits his silhouette. There's not a lot of ass there like there would be for some other DBs.
So, you know, one of the things that I think is fair to say at Clemson is, and this is true of a lot of smaller players, and there's another player I want to ask you about with this in mind, tend to be pretty good downhill players. So with his kind of quickness, he can, he depends on coming downhill quickly to the point of the catch and making a play. He doesn't want to wait for somebody to come to him. That's the wrong way to try and solve that problem. And probably any kind of interaction he has with the run game is that. But I do know, you've heard from various sources, Ryan Mink had an article about playing Ardarius Washington and on the split field role that Geno Stone had last year, basically trying him out at safety. Also that Pepe Williams has seen a little bit of time there so far. And I'm thinking both those guys are completely the wrong body type to be in a cover two safety role, completely the wrong body type. I mean, even if they have pretty good instincts getting to things, if they have to tackle a running back, it's a bad situation for them. It's just it's not ideal, and I would project very high missed tackle rates from something like that. You want a guy like that playing a short zone scheme, would?
Right. I mean, even Geno Stone, you know, God love him,
sure,
incredible player last year, but there were some plays, there were some games. Think of the Browns comeback in Baltimore where he was just not able to tackle guys in open space. And I think some of those athletic deficiencies were never more apparent than when Geno had to come up and tackle guys in space. And Geno has probably 2 inches and I don't know, 10 to 20 pounds on a guy like Ardarius Washington. So
yeah,
I'm in agreement. I it was kind of hammered home to me when I was doing my top 20 Ravens story for 2024, just how often Kyle Hamilton lined up in the slot. When I looked at the PFF splits, it was like 200 snaps at deep safety, 200 snaps in the box, and then like 400 in the slot. It's easy to forget, I think, because we consider him, because we call him safety Kyle Hamilton, that he was softer at his best and at his most comfortable when he was lined up in the slot. And that raises a huge question of how you go about either replicating that or, you know, finding a home for him where he's as effective if you don't have that third safety or whatever you want to call it, that guy in the slot who you can trust upon.
Well, here's the thing about the snaps Kyle Hamilton in the slot. There were several games where they were forced into moving Kyle Hamilton back to the back end or didn't have him available. So you start with games where he got hurt, and there are a couple of those. You add another one where he got ejected for the helmet-to-helmet hit, so he didn't play, you know, some of that. And then there's other times where Geno missed, I think, a little bit of time, but it wasn't much. But Marcus Williams missed time and was otherwise ineffective with the tackling, but he missed some time as well. And when they did that, they weren't in a position that they could do anything but move Kyle Hamilton back to a strong safety role. And that's what the Ravens really need to make sure they can avoid this year. And I'm throwing my arms up that this late in the offseason, they really haven't found a split field guy. There's lots of veterans out there. There's guys who can really do it, but the guys they have on the roster, Bo Braid and...
Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious, high-potency gummies, top-shelf flower, home-baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary, you can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sanusi Kane, I don't think either of them is from their college play. It looks like a back end, you know, split field guy. Certainly not Kane. Kane looks like a dimeback and special teams player only to me. But you tell me, you've watched these two guys play, and I haven't so far in terms of Braid and Kane. Does either of those guys really look like they could play the back end?
Well, Braid has pretty similar measurables to Geno coming out of college. And obviously, you know, I watched a good bit of him with him being a Maryland guy. But remember, he did not do basically anything this spring. I think he was maybe finally active for like a day or two of minicamp as he was coming back from that, I think, that ankle sprain that knocked him out at rookie minicamp. So I really do not have a good sense of how he's faring with the NFL speeds and everything. Kane had a couple picks, I think, in OTAs. So he kind of got on people's radar. But again, you know, you're really only focusing on the safeties at these sessions if they're making picks or getting beat deep. And with him being, you know, a rosterable guy, he was also doing a lot of stuff with the reserves as opposed to the first string guy. So couldn't give you a sense for just what he did. I know he moved around a lot at Purdue. I think he, you know, had some snaps in the slot. I think he had some snaps as a deep safety, just judging by his PFF distribution. But I don't really have a good sense for how close he might be to being the next Geno Stone.
Okay. All right. In my mind, I've kind of already ruled it out, but it's also fairly unusual that somebody who's a true free safety candidate drops all the way to round seven. I mean, it's actually the total number of produced right in college that are good is not that many. And you know, you take pick number 250 and you spend it on a safety, it's probably a special teams, four unit special teams guy and a dime back if you're lucky. And probably not much more than that. And unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of talk about Justin Simmons this year and how he could really help the Ravens. Guy's been terrible in coverage the last 2 years. I mean, awful. 9 yards a target this last year, and that was an improvement from 10 yards a target the year before. So it's just, I'm like, this is not what the Ravens need. They basically would be trying to get another Kyle Hamilton, you know, a guy that could move around and do everything if they go after Justin Simmons. He's definitely not a deep half field guy anymore. He's lost it in terms of coverage. And the other guys, Jamal Adams, that they talk about all, I mean, they're close to the line of scrimmage, more linebackers than anything else that they are talking about getting.
I'm glad you mentioned the Simmons thing, Ken, because I frankly haven't done a whole lot of work on what he would bring to the Ravens, just because I feel like it's a pipe dream with what I assume his price tag would be. But I'm surprised that you say that he struggled as much as he did, because was the reputation of him so strong that he was making all pro the last 3 years based on reputation alone? Because I mean, I feel like all pro is usually a pretty good barometer of whether a guy is actually good or just fake good. Like, you see a lot of these guys who make it to the Pro Bowl.
Right. So Simmons has always been a guy probably like Patrick Queen, who's put tons of splash plays on tape. So you get that kind of good, but he gets beat plenty too. And there was another safety, and I'm trying to remember who it is now. My old man memory is getting me right now. The safety that he might have got drafted around number 100, and I was just so relieved when he got taken off the board, because he's a terrible guy. Give it up. He had 5 picks last year, but he allowed over 13 yards per target at the college level. So he's a completely all or nothing guy. And I was just so happy the Ravens didn't draft him. But most people had him in their top five safeties. I mean, it's just, it was, you know, that's just how bereft of true free safety talent you can get in an NFL draft. And he couldn't be in my top 10 with those kind of statistics. But yeah, I think it's more of a queen type situation. I honestly don't know how PFF graded him. I don't have it up right now, but it'd be interesting to see if they gave him a good coverage grade. His coverage statistics are terrible. And really just look at yards per target. If you just look at that as the starting point for players, you generally get a good sense of how much they're getting beat relative to how often they're making the play on the receiver, whether it means coming downhill, making tackles for loss on screens, whatever it might be.
It looks like 2022 coverage grade of 74.3. Last year was down to it was 63.4.
Okay, so 74.2 in the previous year, and wasn't it like 416 yards on 41 targets? That's what I remember. It should be in there in the coverage statistics.
He allowed a passer. He allowed 12.2 yards per reception and a passer rating in coverage of 101.9.
Okay, not per target. Although that's a bad passer rating. It's the yards divided by the targets. I think it was his yards allowed were 416 and his targets were only 41 on the year. So that'd be over 10. It'd be like 10.15 yards per target. You can't see it.
Yeah, I don't see
it. Okay. It's in there. It's in there in the coverage statistics for PFF. If you look, I don't have it up right now, but I can bring it up after the show. We can have a little discussion about it.
Sure.
Let's get back to Nate Wiggins a little bit. The other thing I really loved about Nate Wiggins that I think is just really bodes well for his college career is I have not seen a defensive back who trusts his makeup speed the way Wiggins does. He was penalized just once all season. And just wonderful job of not becoming grabby and just saying, oh, no problem, I got it. It's Deion Sanders-like in a way.
Yeah, and I do wonder if he's going to have a couple of welcome to the NFL moments because of that proclivity. Like I watched the Florida State game and the North Carolina game because of the NFL-level talent at the wide receiver spot. And the first snap of the Florida State game, Johnny Wilson, not exactly a burner, like a guy who – I think he ran like a 4.55 thereabouts, you know, but because of his size, you know, the discourse around him during the draft process was, is he going to be a wide receiver that these NFL teams are going to try to convert to a tight end? I forgot. I think he landed with the Eagles and I think they're going to keep him at wide receiver and just maybe play him in the slot. But anyway, first snap of the Florida State game, vertical rep by Johnny Wilson within like five steps, he's already got separation on Nate Wiggins. I don't know what his keys were. I don't know if there was something that he was expecting, but it was pretty surprising to see this guy who has this world-class speed getting dusted by a guy who is probably 2/10 of in the 40 slower than him. And then I think like maybe the next snap or a couple snaps later, he lined up against Keon Coleman. Keon Coleman runs a vertical route. Nate Wiggins is also left in the dust a little bit. So it's funny to see a guy, first of all, not get punished for those, but also
those were just missed. Probably.
I think it was, you know, they weren't even attempted. They weren't even part of the progression, it looked like. So neither of those plays resulted in a target for Wilson or for Coleman. I don't think Wiggins got a whole lot of targets, to be honest, in that Florida State game. But it's funny because, for one, that he wasn't punished for it so early in the game, but also just that there was probably, you know, an understanding an understanding by me that this is probably part of the plan. Like he would much rather be in their back pocket on a comeback route than, you know, giving up than letting them have that kind of time and space to turn on him and kind of box him out because of their size, just knowing that he would be able to probably catch up to any pass that Jordan Travis would have thrown downfield because of that elite makeup speed that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. He wants to come downhill. Deion had a little bit of an aversion to tackling in his NFL career in the thing. Hopefully that won't be a thing for Wiggins. But anyway, that you mentioned that NC game. That game was an unbelievably great Wiggins game, despite the touchdown allowed. He also knocked the ball free after Hampton had a 64-yard run. I think it was Hampton. for North Carolina, had the 64-yard run, and he knocked the ball out and punched it through the end zone at the one-yard line. It's
remarkable that you bring up the tackling issues and then go straight to the North Carolina game, because I think what is overlooked on that remarkable play is that Nate Wiggins has to make it, because he is a little bit tardy and a little bit weak in actually ripping free of the block of Tez Walker on that one. Like, it is a play where if you go back and watch the All 22, if he gets, you know, free of Vontaze Walker like a half second earlier, a step sooner, then that lane that Hampton takes, you know, on the right side of the field down the sideline is probably not there, because Nate Wiggins is probably there. So you get the good and you get the bad with Nate Wiggins as a run defender in that play, where he's not going to give up, but also you wish that he would have been able to be there a little bit more aggressively so that this run probably wouldn't have happened in the first place.
When I saw that play in particular, it reminded me of Dwayne Stark's first NFL game against the Steelers in 1998. The Ravens were trailing 20-13. Jerome Bettis was in the clear running for a game sealing touchdown with, I think, about 2 minutes to play. And Dwayne Starks ran him down from behind, punched the ball through the end zone and out for the Ravens to get the ball back. Just an absolutely incredible comeback play, but it's very similar in terms of what happened in that game. And I was thinking finally of that. I love it when anytime a cornerback, and you correctly mentioned here that Wiggins was probably part of the problem, not just part of the solution on that play, but anytime a quarterback makes a great rundown play, I always love it. It's also Lardarius Webb in the Saints Monday Night Football game in 2013, I think it was. What year would they have played the Saints? Does that sound right? Might have been 2014. I think they played him in 2018 when Tucker missed the extra point, in 2014.
Right.
It would have been at New Orleans that we were at the game. And Webb ran across the field to run somebody down, knock him out at the 1 yard line. Then the Ravens stopped him on 4th and 2 right there. Wow. So it ended up being a really important play in a game that they end up winning. So I'd love seeing those kind of things when it gets really paid off, especially. But let's close it down here. We know some things about Wiggins from his college play, but in the NFL, what would be a good season for you in this rookie year?
I keep coming back to like a Marlon Humphrey rookie season reproduction. I think there are a lot of similarities between what Marlon was stepping into in, gosh, what was that, 2016?
17.
Do you recall?
What 17, I think. I could be wrong. I'll check it while you're going.
But like, that was a team that had Jimmy Smith, who I think was healthy through most of that season. I believe they had, who else do they have? They had Brandon Carr, who was, I think, a very effective that year. I think Tavon Young probably would have been on that team. So there was a lot of defensive back talent. I think that was a year where the Ravens finished like top five in DVOA and in pass efficiency. So I think that was a very talented and productive unit that Marlon got dropped into. And I think he ended up playing like 56% of the defensive snaps that year. I think he only had a couple starts, which are, you know, obviously can be a little bit misleading, because you can still be playing buku snaps as Marlon did that year and mm-hmm. not necessarily get starts. So I think if he can have the kind of impact that Marlon did, not necessarily, you know, ball production wise, but just show himself capable of getting onto the field regularly in high leverage moments against really good teams, you know, matching up against players based on matchups, showing maybe in spots that he can line up in the slot, which is obviously something that he didn't do a whole lot of at Clemson. I think that would be a really nice first step to what should be a really, really exciting career.
Okay. All right. Very good. By the way, 2017, just to backtrack for a second, I remember being at camp the day, actually camp or OTAs was one of the two, where Tavon Young lost his ACL for the year. Okay, so he got injured,
but they were still so good without him.
Yes, they were. Marlon Humphrey was at the podium that day, and so I asked him. have you played any in the slot? He goes, no, I practiced at Alabama, but I never played in the slot. Right. I'd actually be very surprised if Wiggins gets moved to the slot. I think Humphrey is the natural one to move to the slot because of the physical nature of his play. I think you already have Hamilton there, so you don't really want a lot of slot snaps. You don't have those either, but you want slot snaps out of your outside corners too much on this team. I am interested to see if Humphrey maybe could step in at safety and allow Hamilton the flexibility to play back or front on a by play basis. That could be a huge weapon if they could develop that, but it is a big ask.
Yeah, I'll toss in. I think I forget exactly what the parameters of my search were, but when I had access to the NFL's Next Gen Stats Data Hub, I think I looked at like Marlon's target success rate when he was outside versus when he was inside. Let's just say it was like for the past 2 years, because obviously it hasn't been it's been a good, not great past 2 years, but for when he was an outside cornerback, he was like above average for target success rate, which means that he was doing his job at like 60th percentile. But in the slot, when targeted, he was elite, which is obviously not surprising considering everything we know about Marlon and just how good he's been when he's aligned inside.
Shows you that you really need instincts more than you need really change of direction speed in the slot sometimes. And the physicality is always useful there, whether you're doing any of the things that Kyle Hamilton did. But no, it's not really surprising. You know, if you have a great outside corner, you always feel like you're wasting him to bring him into the slot. But with Humphrey, I think he could play a lot of positions. The Ravens current, just to go down a rabbit hole for a second here, the Ravens current dilemma in terms of really need to find out what they need, what they have in 2025 with Stevens and Humphrey, both in kind of crossroads years. Stevens obviously in his contract year, and Humphrey in a year where if his play were to take a downturn, I think he's cut before 25 or restructured in some way, with a cut in pay. But it's a big crossroads year for Humphrey. Stevens, I don't think you can move him and have anything but a very unhappy player who wants to get paid as a cornerback. And if you try to move him to safety and fill in this back end need and have Wiggins and Humphrey be your outside guys, I think Stevens would be very unhappy about it. I think rightfully so. He had a good year and really deserves to stay there. But I think Humphrey is at a point in his career where he could play any of those three positions and not necessarily decrease his value at all. In fact, it might lengthen his career for another team or the Ravens to see that he could move to safety. Very well.
Again, do you know what the most surprising reminder to me of Brandon Stevens' safety experience? I was just messing around on PFF and clicked on one of the sorters, and that filter was weight, and it was just the cornerback list, and I don't know if it was like the list of 50 or 100. But it was obviously a substantial sample size. And of the cornerbacks who made that sample on that PFF filter page, Brandon Stevens was the heaviest, which is kind of surprising to me, but also not surprising that a guy who, played running back, has played safety, would be the heaviest cornerback of this rather, representative NFL sample. So, you say it's probably unlikely. I agree, but it was a kind of funny out of nowhere reminder that, oh yeah, this guy is probably built more like a safety than he is a cornerback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the thing is, it might be the right move for the Ravens. It'd be so the wrong move for Stevens to go back to safety if he's got a chance to be a good corner. I'd hate to see it be done to him. And I really don't think the Ravens will, after using him basically every snap last year at right corner and him solidifying that unit. Let me go back to Wiggins if I can. I'm going to drop through my good season very quickly. Stays healthy throughout the preseason. Very important. Keeps his soft tissue health so he gets actual playing time in the preseason. And is immediately part of the cornerback picture. Plays at least rotationally, 400 plus snaps, 13 plus games, at no worse than a league average level. Any tackling issues are minor, and he shows the ability to come downhill and make plays. I'm not expecting him to be the greatest tackler in the secondary in terms of trying to get a running back to the ground. I'm expecting some climb on your back play. Continues to be able to rely on recovery speed and avoid significant uptick in penalties. You very well could be right about some welcome to the NFL moments there. development track remains that of a potential Pro Bowl player, although he isn't there yet as a rookie. And again, this is at the 60th percentile result. The Ravens are confident they have a quality cornerback and can use that information in deciding how to proceed with the contracts for Stevens and Humphrey. Projects a full-time play in 2025.
I think one important thing that we probably both overlooked, although I mentioned right at the top of the discussion, just puts on 5 pounds of good weight.
Yeah, there you go. That
is,
okay.
That is the that is the plan for him. You do not want him to be looking like Emmanuel Forbes out there.
All right. Well, fair enough. So what would you add for a great season here?
I think it would be unrealistic to put these kind of expectations on him, but I think the Ravens have kind of sort of invited it by Eric DaCosta calling Wiggins the best cover corner in this draft. You know, you look at just what some of the top cornerbacks in recent memory have done as a rookie. You know, Devin Witherspoon comes in to Seattle. I think he's what, Pro Bowl or All Pro year one. Sauce Gardner comes in year one, one of the NFL's, you know, best two or three cornerbacks in the league. The year before that, Pat Surtain, not a out and out star immediately for Denver, but I think the next year is his first Pro Bowl or All Pro nod. But obviously, he was, you know, good enough to start, like, I think 8 or 10 games or something like that for that Broncos team. So if the Ravens really do believe in this guy's star potential, then I think there is an outside chance that this guy comes in right away, is just, you know, one of the best cornerbacks in this division, maybe this conference, maybe the NFL. I just think, you know, obviously we know about his ability to kind of click and close. We know about how well he can contest jump balls with that great jumping ability. And there's a great, you know, breakup of a kind of Hail Mary attempt at the end of the North Carolina game, where it just really shows how coordinated he is and just how much bounce he has on some of those deep ball attempts. You know, can he tackle well? Can he be a guy whose hands are good? You know, that's obviously been a bit of a mark against Marlon, just not being able to grab those sure thing interceptions. So I think it's really exciting to see what his potential could be, because there aren't a lot of guys with his height, with his speed, with his confidence. I mean, he's a guy who's not much for press conference sound bites, because I think he's pretty well, you know, secure in who he is. He doesn't feel like he needs to prove anything to anyone. You know, from what I saw in those two games, was able to kind of pass off zones very well. You know, obviously didn't have any fear about moving to the slot if it meant that he was kind of, you know, having to cover Tez Walker, a one-on-one in man coverage. So you can do a lot of really, really interesting things with him. And I'm excited to see just what he might be. I mean, you know, it might not be long, Ken, before we're talking about, you know, Nate Wiggins being the most talented cornerback in this room because of the state of Marlon's injury situation, because maybe Brandon Stevens comes back to earth a little bit without Mike McDonald, and, you know, Denard Wilson kind of helping to guide his hand a little bit. So the world is his oyster, as far as I'm concerned, if you believe the Ravens and the Ravens officials and just how good this guy could be right away.
Okay. So let's stick a percentage on that. What's the chance of Wiggins being the best cornerback, being the best cornerback for the Ravens this season? I'm going to write my number down, because I don't think it's that low either.
I would say like 15 or 20%.
Okay. I was going to say 35. I honestly think there's, you know, it's pretty much a toss up between the three. Humphrey's got things to overcome. Stevens got the things to prove after not a great close to last year. And Wiggins obviously has to earn playing time in that group. But I think, you know, basically I'd call it almost a dead even split of the three of them. So I might have set my great year a little bit too low, but I'll read it off how I said it. Plays above the league average and demands a full-time role by no later than midseason. Plays 700 plus snaps in 16 plus games. Presence allows the Ravens to deploy Humphrey as most needed, whether that's outside, slot corner, or safety. I'm putting it in there. Ravens, they don't have to do anything about it if they want to play him outside rotationally or at slot only. That's the way it'll be, but safety could really help. Ball production, recovery speed, and penalty avoidance are similar to that at Clemson. Sticky play forces lots of altered throws from interception-leery quarterbacks. Actually wrote that improperly as interception L-E-A-R-Y quarterbacks. Now I realize that's a real Freudian slip that Leary might be playing against him on a number two field somewhere and would be very leery of interceptions as well. He's a star in the making who projects as the Ravens starter for 25 to 28 and will compete for postseason honors over that period. Doesn't have to be there in the first year, projects to be that for 25 to 28.
Those are good. And actually, I think one thing we should probably mention, Ken, in this is if you were just kind of ballpark it, how many snaps last year do you think the Ravens outside cornerbacks lined up in press coverage?
In press coverage?
No cushion.
Okay. Do you have the number available to us? So I'm guessing. So,
I don't. Okay. I mean, I think of standout, maybe, what's the word I'm looking for? Maybe not representative examples, but I remember when the week 11 win over the Bengals, it was Brandon Stevens lined up in press coverage against Ja'Marr Chase on 31 of 37 dropbacks or something like that. So that was obviously notable for how well he did it. But I do think the Ravens, for the most part, have liked to play press coverage, if not bump and run, but, not giving guys totally clean releases at the line of scrimmage.
Right. That works very well when you're starting with two high safeties, because you can take away routes with one of your safeties, obviously, and you all can also just match up zone on both sides and take away some of what the corners will give you by being in press. And the Ravens are obviously extraordinarily good at that. They were on pace to set the record for the fewest yards given up in a per pass play since 2000. They fell short of that, unfortunately, but we're really looking good in that regard. It was a big year, and I hope Orr continues with the starting cover two looks. A few years ago, I couldn't believe I would say this, that I don't really care that much if he plays a committed nickel or not, because I think it might benefit the Ravens. It might not, with Simpson in there. And if Orr becomes over reliant on a committed nickel, I don't even think that would be the biggest thing about the Ravens defense that could go wrong. I think the biggest thing would be is if they lose kind of sight of who they are as a team that starts with cover two and forces the quarterback to throw the ball underneath. You look at Joe Burrow, he's helpless against the Ravens because he does not have the arm strength to throw it deep down the field with two safeties there. And, the time he tried, he was 0-for-7, I think, in the game, including that where Geno Stone had the pick. He was 0-for-7 on balls of 15 plus yards. I love to see the Ravens be able to force the other team into small ball.
Yeah. Well, and I bring up the press coverage because when you watch the film, at least these two games, Florida State, North Carolina, you're not getting a lot of reps of Nate Wiggins where he is lined up in the guy's grill. It is him off the ball by 7, 8, sometimes 10 yards. And some of these might've been 1st and 10 snaps. So you wonder, does he have the strength to reroute these guys at the line of scrimmage? I mean, he doesn't have to be, it could be kind of a soft shoe coverage where he's not looking to totally jam them up. He's just kind of looking to stick in their hip pocket from the moment the ball is snapped. But I think that is going to be a potentially significant learning curve. He's probably disadvantaged a little bit by the fact that the Ravens don't have a true great downfield X, someone who could be who could weaponize their body strength. I mean, it was interesting. I think that the one play of his that sticks out a little bit from either minicamp or one of the final OTAs was, Zay Flowers running an 8-yard comeback against him. And I think there was a little bit of separation, where Zay is using his body and his hands and his shoulder to get that kind of wiggle room that he needed to get to open the throwing window for Lamar, whoever was, dropping back to pass. So is he going to be able to hold up in that kind of close to the line coverage? If that means that he has to be, responsible for also not giving up those windows of separation when a guy is, you know, maybe running a power slant or, you know, being physical on a comeback or that kind of thing. It's just, it's something to kind of keep in mind when you consider what he did at Clemson and maybe what might be asked of him in Baltimore.
Okay. Let me try and respond to that. For starters, I think if he plays left cornerback primarily, which is where I expect him to line up most of the time, I think Stevens will be a full-time right cornerback. He'll probably split time with Humphrey to some degree. And maybe Humphrey moves over to right corner a little bit with Wiggins on the field as well. So I think he stays at left cornerback most of the time. More often than not, a lot more often than not, that's the strong side of the field where the slot receiver is and where Kyle Hamilton is, more importantly. Kyle Hamilton is the greatest horizontal defender in the entire NFL. He takes away the strong side of the football field. And if you can afford to have a poor tackling cornerback on one side, it would be Wiggins on that side would potentially not be in the best possible situation he can be in for not being put in a position to make high leverage tackles all by himself. So at least that should work in his favor, I hope, in terms of whether he's off ball or whether they try and, you know, make him into a press corner. I mean, sometimes just don't fit the square peg into a round hole. I mean, honestly, you might want to play press. You might just not have the personnel to play press. And if you want to play some press on a series, get Humphrey in there with Stevens instead of Wiggins. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how the snap distributions play out because, you know, if all is normal and healthy in the typical Ravens game, then you expect at the end of the game to see Marlon Humphrey having played 100% of the snaps, Brandon Stevens having played 100% of the snaps, the safeties having played 100% of the snaps, but maybe they will go a little bit more bespoke in how they line up those guys because of Wiggins and because, I don't know, you know, maybe Jalen Armour-Davis, you know, has a great camp and really proves himself worthy of getting snaps. Maybe Arthur Mallette, you know, kind of builds on what he showed last year and you know, works himself into getting roles in certain spots. So I'm sure Chris Hewitt is delighted to have as much talent as he does at his disposal, but it's going to be really interesting to see how he and Harbaugh and Orr kind of figure out what that means for playing time, because frankly, I think like anything is on the table.
Right. Yeah. It is a very talented secondary. Also, you know, we've talked a lot about this on the offensive side of the ball, but you are talking about alignment here, but the skill position snaps for the Ravens just in very short supply among a talented group of, you know, the tight end and fullback group being four deep. And, you know, they all probably want to play 50% of the snaps. And there's just not enough snaps for that to happen. And you got wide receivers,
I did a story a couple of weeks ago on just the possibility of 12 personnel with, you know, all the hype about around Andrews and Likely. And I didn't realize this stat was a thing until after. It would have been helpful to have it for the story. But Ken, do you want to take a guess ballpark at what Isaiah Likely's snap share was, what his snap percentage was on offense from week 2 to week 10, which was when Andrews came back healthy game before that Bengals game?
Because he was hardly targeted during that entire time. So week 2 week 3 I guess he had the big drop against Indianapolis. So I'm going to give you a notional thing that he might have played about 18 to 25% of the snaps in that range.
Yep, I think it was 25%. Do you want to guess what that number rose to after week 11?
88%. I'm just guessing.
Close-ish. I think he was around 60 or 65%. Okay. So he goes from a guy getting, I think he's probably like sixth or seventh on the depth chart, so to speak, in terms of offensive snaps, to being the guy who is only out-snapped among the skill position players by Zay Flowers, which is just kind of incredible that, you know, obviously like injuries create those kind of, you know, disproportions and stuff like that. But it was just kind of mind blowing to see him going from being someone who was not the guy in any kind of way to being someone who had to be the guy because Andrews, and obviously Bateman was, you know, splitting snaps with Odell, who was hurt, and, you know, the running back rotation and everything. But that was just a really, really surprising, shocking before and after split that I probably should have expected, but was still kind of wild to see on the page.
It's kind of amazing the year Likely had with that little playing time. The Ravens tight ends as a whole, you've probably heard me say this before, but first of all, he had 12 touchdowns, no interceptions, throwing to the tight end with a passer rating just north of 140. Okay, the passer rating thrown to Andrews, highest of his career, at 135.
I think Isaiah Likely's passer rating when he was targeted by Lamar was 156.3.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I know it was over 140 because he was part of the one that was bringing up, and Kolar's also was over 140. So just an incredible year that can't be repeated.
Didn't Andrews finish? I think Andrews finished tied for first among tight ends in receiving touchdowns despite playing basically half the season.
Yeah. Looks good so far from what I've heard about Andrews, but you've actually observed with your own eyes. How has he looked so far?
Yep. Looks like his old self again, which is definitely good. I was surprised to go back and look at his snap breakdown from that Chiefs game. Cause I think he played like 18 snaps and he obviously had the two catches, but it felt like much, much less. And I don't know, I guess that there's probably a world in which Mark Andrews is healthy for that game. And his mere presence probably puts the Ravens in the Super Bowl, because I think what that offense needed against a secondary as physical as Kansas City's was someone who not only had that intuitive connection with Lamar, but someone who could just body these guys in a way that you couldn't expect Zay to. Isaiah Likely, not really a guy who's going to, you know, bench press a dude to get off of him. I think just watching what Mark was able to do during OTAs, during minicamp, and then kind of transposing that onto that Chiefs game, where, you know, you think about how that first drive ends for Lamar. It's him looking for Nelson Aguilar, well covered over the middle on a route that, you know, in an ideal world, Mark Andrews is probably running and getting pretty open on.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jonas, always a pleasure to talk. We've been an hour and 13 minutes now, and I apologize for keeping you so long, but it's always so much fun to talk football with you, and looking forward to seeing you soon one way or another. Tell folks where they can read your work online.
Yeah, kind of a dry period now, obviously, with not a whole lot of content going up, but did top 20 Ravens projected for 2024 on the baltimorebanner.com. Obviously, we've got training camp coming up in 9 days time. I'm hoping to do something on Marlin and just, you know, whether that season was as bad as some people would like to believe or would like to tell you. Hoping to do that sometime around the start of training camp. So yeah, you know, obviously we've got a bunch of people who will be out at the facility covering stuff. I'm toying with the idea of keeping like as detailed stats as you can, where maybe if I have enough time on my hands and I don't have enough going on socially to occupy me, that I do like success rate for these quarterbacks, because I get the feeling that Devin Leary might not fare so well, and neither nor might Josh Johnson, with just how often those guys like to kind of check down the ball versus Lamar, who's obviously a little bit more prone to pump the ball downfield. So I'm hoping to have some cool stats for folks who are covering who are reading our coverage at the Banner.
All right. Outstanding. And you're at Jonas_Schaefer on X. I'm sure people who are following probably are doing it already, but Jonas is an excellent follow, and you get all that great Banner content of his, and obviously a very deep and cerebral way of looking about football that I really appreciate, Jonas. So thanks for coming on. Other folks out there, let me ask you.
Thanks for having me.
Other folks out there, please, if you'd like to be on a film study short, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. I'd love to hear your idea for a show, and I treat this as an open mic. So if you have an idea, don't be shy, and I'll get back to you. The Concerns series, if you want to be on that, the time is ticking on that. But one concern about the 2024 Ravens, I just had a concern today about the Ravens not adapting well enough in the postseason in terms of a play calling basis. That's a great idea for a concern to do after the regular season, but I don't really want to hear about like what the Ravens don't do well in the playoffs. I want to have some concerns about the regular season because the Ravens aren't there yet. And, Jonas, appreciate you coming on.
Of course, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and Watch or Tap, also on them. Service plan required for Watch or Tap. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Access big savings every day, all in the Kroger app. Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.